someone's listening to this right now and they have got a psychopathic coworker, what advice would you have for that person working alongside this person?
When you are in a workplace with a psychopath initially, they will be the most wonderful person you've ever encountered. They will tell you exactly what you want to hear, and you will think, wow, this is great. Once they've got enough information for leverage where they can start to manipulate people, they drop all that and they're just their more normal self, which is usually highly manipulative, often quite aggressive.
So we've got the coworker now. Now I want to go to the next level, which is the boss. This is where I can imagine it becomes a lot more tricky for people to navigate.
When it's your boss, you then really have to get out of there, is ultimately the only solution. They will destroy your life as easily as, you know, make a cup of coffee. And in the meantime, they'll work you like a slave, take all the credit for everything you do. So you can tell when this is happening in an organization. There are really obvious red flags. One of them is
David, welcome to the Career Confidence Podcast today. I'm really excited to get stuck into this conversation. I'm sure it's going to be quite eye-opening for many. But before I dive into some questions I've got for you today, can you just quickly give a little bit of an introduction to who you are, your background, and your own personal career journey? So, David, over to you.
Okay. All right. So, I'm a lawyer by day and always have been the whole time I've been writing. I've been writing nonfiction books now for I guess my first one came out in 2007. That was a book about why we shouldn't eat so much sugar and what it does to us besides making us fat, also all the various illnesses it gives us. And it's a book called Sweet Poison. And it's probably the book that most people know me for. I've written 14 other nonfiction books in areas as diverse as psychology, which we're going to talk a little bit about today, and psychopaths and working with them, various other nutrition things, education, bunch of things. I'm thoroughly unqualified to talk about any of those things. And I think that's probably the value that I bring to my audience, in the sense that my day job doesn't depend on me sticking to a corporate line in respect of any of the things that I say. I will not be fired for telling you that sugar makes you fat. I will not be fired for telling you how to handle your psychopathic boss. All I am doing is using, I guess, a legal mind and the research skills I've been trained with to investigate what the evidence actually says, translate it into language that I can understand and therefore probably most people can, and write that down. And hopefully come out with some practical guidance about how to live your life as a result of what that evidence says. So that's what I do. The latest book I've written is a book about working with psychopaths called Toxic at Work. I guess, like most of the things I write about, it was inspired by things that had happened to me in real life. Because if I'm not interested in it, I'm not going to write a book about it. I like almost everyone in your audience, I suspect, has encountered the personality type we're going to discuss today. Now, I call them a psychopath, and we can get down to definitions and so on shortly, but everyone has. And if you've got a member of your audience sitting there saying, well, I don't know what they're talking about, I've never encountered anyone like this at all, then guess who the psychopath is?
Oh, this is going to be good. Okay. So, yeah, first and foremost, can you just clarify what you mean by a psychopath? Because I have this vision of a murderer who's going to cut me up into a million pieces and put me in the trunk of his car. But what actually do you mean when you say a psychopath at work?
Well, I mean that. But I also, a more broad and general definition, which is that there are two types of people in the world. There are people with empathy and people without empathy. Empathy is a system for group behavior that humans evolved to enable us to cooperate with each other on the basis of trust. So we get very, very good at putting ourselves in the position of the person we're dealing with and being able to make assumptions about how they will behave based on how we would behave. And we use a reasonably complicated system of wiring in our brains to hard code the circuitry for empathy, which essentially allows us to read each other on the fly and react instinctively and automatically in sub-second timeframes based on those readings. And we call that empathy, and we can drill down a little bit more detail about what that's like and why we have it. But in essence, what it allows us to do is cooperate with strangers. Humans are the only animals on the planet that cooperate with large groups of strangers. And by strangers, I mean people we're not related to. So lots of animals can cooperate in groups with people they're related to. Wolf packs, for example, are essentially large families. Ants and bees and so on are essentially one organism. But humans are the only ones with distinct individuals who can cooperate as if they were a family and as if they cared for each other, but they're not actually related. And the way we do that is with this evolutionary adaptation called empathy, where we've, I guess, seconded some circuitry that many other animals use for things like very, very highly developed senses of smell or sight. And we have used it for reading emotions. So we are extremely good at receiving almost telepathically the emotions of another human. And if we feel that our actions will make that human unhappy, then we will probably change those actions. In other words, we take other people's emotions into account in our own planning. Psychopaths don't. So they're an evolutionary throwback when you look at the circuitry, for example, there's really good recent work on this where they've actually studied. You can only do this once someone's dead, unfortunately. So, you know, forget any plans to do it to your boss. But you can study the particular parts of the brain where this resides. You can also study it over the growth lifespan of a human. And some interesting things are revealed by the science on that, which is that no human has empathy at birth. So it's, you know, anyone who's had anything to do with a baby knows that they're psychopaths. And by that, I mean entirely self-interested. They don't care about your feelings. They care about the fact that they are tired or they need to be fed or they need their nappy changed. So babies are psychopaths, and that's because they don't have that circuitry. By the age of four, all humans have developed adult-level versions of that circuitry, except for about 1 in 20 of us. And they are an evolutionary throwback that never develops it. So remain entirely self-interested their entire life. So a psychopath, by my definition, is someone who does not have empathy. And I don't mean they don't have feelings or they can't operate in society. They can't understand other humans. They can do all of that. But what they don't do is have automatic taking account of your interests. So it's almost like extreme selfishness. If killing you gets them slightly more wealth than not killing you and they can get away with it, then killing you is a viable option. It's not a viable option for most of us because we take account of the fact that you might not like to be killed. So we can override empathy. We can manually decide to commit a crime or do something evil, but we have to override empathy. We have a line there that we have to force ourselves to cross. For a psychopath, there is no line. It's just not there. And they look at the rest of us in wonderment, seeing ourselves limited in that way, and think we are impaired and that we are the ones with some kind of disability. All humans were once psychopathic, just as all animals are still psychopathic. But at an evolutionary stage, it's looking like about 100,000 years ago, the vast majority of the human population evolved the capacity for emotional communication and uses it to allow large groups of us to cooperate.
That's probably a much longer explanation than you were planning to get, but that's it.
No, I love it. And this is absolutely fascinating. First thing, 1 in 20, that's pretty scary. So that makes me think, God, I've definitely come across someone with these tendencies. But another thing that you said that really got me thinking was that I just automatically assumed that for people to have these traits, lack empathy, be terrible bosses, or go and do something terrible, it must have come from their childhood. They must have had some kind of trauma to trigger, like hurt people. In your opinion, from the research and studies that you've done then, are you saying that some people are just naturally born this way?
We don't know. Everybody is born without empathy. So the big question is, why do most of us develop it by the age of 4 and some don't? Now, there isn't a good answer on that. There are strong theories about something happens between 0 and 4 that in some way impairs it. I'm not particularly in favor of that. I'm more inclined to the idea that it's just a genetic throwback. At 1 in 20, it's not something that impairs the development of society. It holds it back, but it doesn't impair it sufficiently. It doesn't threaten the welfare of the individual. So evolution would say, well, that's something we can live with in a sense. And so I'm more inclined to the view that genetically they were never capable of developing empathy, and they don't.
Interesting. That's really fascinating. Okay. So you've worked with, I'm sure, a lot of people over your career. Can you maybe share a story of when you have been exposed yourself to a psychopath, someone with no empathy, and what that experience was like for you?
No, and I'll tell you why. And you'll get the same answer from anyone who has worked with a psychopath. If that person is still alive, they are still a threat to you. Psychopaths are extremely vengeful. It's one of the characteristics of them. They are extraordinarily thin-skinned, and they take any action that is even mildly critical of them as a direct assault on them, for which they must exact revenge. And they're often quite tireless in exacting revenge. So I can't give you an example, although there are many, of psychopaths I've worked with and for. The closest I can come is encourage you to read in the book, and I really hate telling people to buy a book to do this, but unfortunately this is the way it has to be with this one. In the book, about a third of the book is a fictional scenario in an office, in a law office, coincidentally, where you get to see the same set of events occurring through the eyes of 4 different characters. One of whom is a psychopath. Now, I don't tell you at the start who is the psychopath. You just get to see the same events through different people's eyes. Let's say it's based on truth. The names have been changed to protect the innocent. But in essence, the reason I did it that way, and the reason I'm reluctant to tell you just a story about a psychopath, is that one of the really big problems with psychopaths is they don't do anything obviously terribly bad, in that what they don't do, and by that I mean something where you would go home and you might talk to your partner or something and say, oh, you know, once again, they didn't put the paper in the photocopier, and your partner would think you're barking mad for suggesting there's something wrong with someone just because they didn't put the paper in the photocopier. But the effect of the way they behave, which is entirely selfish all of the time, they micromanage, they take credit where it's not due, they blame others for all the errors they do, they're inherently lazy and parasitic, and they are vicious one-on-one, meaning, you know, they will attack you where there's not an audience. They'll embarrass you where there is an audience, they, in general, make your life a living hell. So you feel like you're walking on eggshells around them the entire time. You can't predict the way they will behave. And when they come under attack, they viciously counterattack or suddenly acquire an illness which excuses their behavior. So suddenly they're you know, oh, it's depression or like, you know, the some other mystery illness that excuses them, and no one can say anything bad about them. So it's a set of behaviors that over time make your working life with them hell. The impact on a company is that because that person is entirely self-interested, so they don't care about the company's goals, the group's goals, the purpose of the, you know, most of us get together in groups, whether it's a charity, a sporting club, or a company, because we have a purpose that we can only achieve as a group. We can't do it on our own. We need the efforts of all of us working together as a team to do that thing. And psychopaths fundamentally undermine that, because when you throw a psychopath into that grouping, they are only interested in themselves and benefits to themselves. So where you might altruistically do something for the betterment of the group or the betterment of your joint purpose, a psychopath would think you were insane if it resulted in you having to either not take credit for something or suffer a disadvantage because of it. So they don't work that way. What they do is divide people up, have them working against each other and competing with each other. And because in that way, they can skate by without it ever being noticed that they're not really doing anything. So anyway, coming back to the example that's in the book, it's a very common work situation viewed through the eyes of four different people. One of whom is a psychopath, another of whom is a victim who pays the ultimate price, losing her entire career from very mild things that the psychopath just takes advantage of as they happen. So an opportunity occurs, and where you or I might say, oh, well, you know, I couldn't possibly do that. That would have dreadful consequences. The psychopath says, she's irritating me. I'll do that. And so what if they don't even think about the consequences? It ends up destroying this woman's career, but so what? That's another person she doesn't have to climb over to get further in the organization. It also shows you what it looks like from above. So what does the boss of the psychopath see? What are they being told by the psychopath? And the reason I did it that way in that much depth is that's the only way you really can understand what it's like. Many people, when they read that example, they say, this is describing my life at work. This is exactly, I mean, the particular things might be different, but the process is identical.
Okay. So I know there's going to be people listening to this right now that are working for these types of people, right? So yes. First and foremost, let's take it from another coworker's point of view. So someone's listening to this right now and they have got a psychopathic coworker. What advice would you have for that person working alongside this person?
You have to shield yourselves. So psychopaths are opportunistic. They're not great strategy thinkers. They only really think one move ahead. And one of the mistakes we make in dealing with them is we believe that because we can't understand why they did what they just did, it must be part of some greater strategic plan. And it's not. They're opportunistic. So one of the things you've got to do is avoid giving them opportunities. Don't overshare. Do not give them information about your life. You are at work. You share only work-related information and you answer the question that is asked. Do not give any more information. Do not give them any leverage over you or anybody else. This is really hard to do because one of the things psychopaths are really good at is what's called cognitive empathy, or what the man in the street would call charm. This is why they are always hired, despite the best intentions of HR outfits, because they are extraordinarily charming. They will give you a resume that is 90% lies and they will charm you into believing it. They are very, very good at reading what you want to hear and telling you it. So when you are in a workplace with a psychopath initially, they will be the most wonderful person you've ever encountered. They will tell you exactly what you want to hear and you will think, wow, this is a great – by the way, this is exactly the same as when you're dating them. These are not different scenarios. This is what you get. And then when they have enough information to have leverage over you, they stop bothering with that. That facade takes a lot of energy and effort. And they can't keep it up. And they really can't keep it up in a group because they've often maintained a fake personality for that person and another for that person and another person for that person. Because we don't all like the same things, but they've convinced each of us that they like the things we like. So it's a lot of effort. So once they've got enough information for leverage where they can start to manipulate people, they drop all that. And they're just their more normal self, which is usually highly manipulative, often quite aggressive, and at least one-on-one. So they may not be aggressive in front of a group, but one-on-one, they'll be very aggressive. One of the things they do is once, you know, I keep saying once they've got leverage on you, what's the leverage? Well, the leverage is they find out things about you. And one of the things they like to find out about people very early on is, can they be pushed to do things which are slightly wrong? So can I get them to fudge the rules? Can I get them to break the internal rules of the organization? You've got to fill in your expense account in a certain way. You've got to have certain justifications, et cetera, et cetera. They'll say, can I get you to be part of claiming something as an expense, which isn't legitimately an expense? You know it's not. They know it's not. But then they've got something over you. And they know something about you too, which is that they can push you into an illegal space. So you have to be absolutely straight as a die. And a brick wall about this, to the point of being antisocial in a sense, in that you are not there to socialize, you are there to work, you will share work information, zero personal information, and you will not ever, under any circumstances, no matter how small, be dishonest.
Okay, so basically what I'm hearing is be very selective with what you tell them, have boundaries, and make sure that they don't know the ins and outs of your personal life, and be very aware if somebody's trying to do something, encourage you to do something that
push
you know
you to do that you know is wrong. And also, I guess, record everything in writing, particularly if the person is your boss. So one of the things psychopaths will frequently do is tell you to do something. You go away and you do it, and then you bring it back to them and say, here, I've done the thing you've asked. And they'd say, well, that wasn't what I asked you to do. You've done it all wrong. And often they'll do that in front of others where they'll be able to. And the reason they're doing that is that they want to run you down in terms of your status, often with both of your boss. So they're trying to make your boss understand that they are the high performer, you are unreliable. Or worse. And the way they do that is set you up to fail by giving you tasks or giving you instructions or passing on instructions to you, which they know are wrong. They do that very much on purpose, and they manipulate using those kinds of tactics. And you might say, wow, that requires a lot of knowledge and a lot of thinking and a lot of effort. How could they be bothered? This is the way they've had to be their entire lives. In order to get anything in their life, they've had to learn to manipulate the rest of us. They've spent their entire lives manipulating empaths. By the time you strike them in their 20s, 30s, 40s in a workplace, they are absolutely professional and automatic at it. So never, ever think they couldn't possibly do this. There's such a minimal benefit in this for them. Don't be so silly. And this is, by the way, what a lot of people will tell you is you say, Jan, stole my chair or whatever because, she wanted that particular chair and so she made my boss believe that I was a drug addict or, something like that. And people say, that is totally ridiculous. You are insane. No one would destroy a person's life or potentially destroy it just to get their chair. But unfortunately, a psychopath, they very definitely would. From their mind, it's a very simple equation. There's a benefit to me, the chair, and if you get hurt, you get hurt. What's the downside to me?
Well, this is quite scary and such a fascinating topic as well, because there's so much talk around toxic, you know, being toxic at work, and it just keeps on coming up. But so we've got the coworker now. Now I want to go to the next level, which is the boss.
Yeah.
This is where I can imagine it becomes a lot more tricky for people to navigate. Advice for those out there.
Well, often the coworker will become your boss because psychopaths are extremely good at charming upwards. And the one place they will maintain that charm is upwards. So anyone who can give them anything will still get the full charm offensive. They only drop the mask when dealing with you because they've determined that either they've got sufficient leverage to control you or you can no longer give them anything. So you become merely a sheep to them, an asset to be used up at will. So they will become your boss almost certainly because they are full time. They're not spending their time working. You're the one working. They're the one taking credit for your work. They're not spending their time working. They're spending their time charming the boss. So the boss thinks, and in this scenario in the book, one of the people is the boss. The boss thinks, oh, you're the problem, not the psychopath. And the reason they believe that is because they are getting constant stories about how you are the problem, put in the nicest possible way about, oh, look, I'm sure, you know, her drinking problem's improving, but, you know, it's good to see her starting to turn up to work before 10 o'clock in the morning. You know, that it'll be a constant stream of that sort of setup, so that by the time you are so frustrated that you go to your boss and complain about the psychopath, you are the problem as far as the boss is concerned, and you are complaining about the golden-haired child. That's why it's always a bad idea to do that. It's a bad idea to confront a psychopath because they will take revenge. It's a bad idea to go round a psychopath because they've already anticipated that and set you up for it. So when it's your boss, you then really have to get out of there is ultimately the only solution. Because if they're your boss and they're not bothering to charm you anymore, then you are just cannon fodder to them. They will destroy your life as easily as, you know, make a cup of coffee. And in the meantime, they'll work you like a slave, take all the credit for everything you do, and in general, enjoy pushing you around. So you can tell when this is happening in an organization. There are really obvious red flags. One of them is when sick leave goes through the roof. So pretty much what starts to happen once a psychopath is in a group of people is people start suffering enormous emotional distress. They hate coming to work. They'll do anything they can to avoid it. Sick leave goes to the roof. If you can get a job somewhere else, you usually do. And the ones that are stuck there take as much sick leave as they can manage. Unpaid leave starts happening. You see that sort of thing happening in an organization, absolute certain you are dealing with a psychopath in that group of people. The problem is the boss will never see it because the boss will be given continuous stories by the person about how all of this is somebody else's problem.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. I wanted to quickly pop in and talk to you about our amazing supporter, CH Talent Solutions. We are an IT and digital recruitment company based in Australia. If you are someone right now looking for a new opportunity or considering a career pivot, please reach out to one of our consultants. Or if you are somebody looking to build your team or build your company or scale, again, please reach out to us if you are looking to find the best tech talent fast. I look forward to connecting with you. Now back to today's episode. Enjoy. God, it's such an interesting topic. And I'm just thinking now of these poor people that are literally working. This is their everyday reality. So let's talk now that somebody that their boss is a psychopath, they're like, I have to get out. But they really feel like their confidence have been eroded, their self-belief, their sense of worth has just been completely depleted.
Yep.
What advice, if any, Dave, would you have for those people now finding themselves looking for a new job, but back on the workforce, or maybe they've just joined a new company and they're a bit nervous and they feel like their confidence has taken a hit? Any advice for those types of people?
Yeah, I can give advice, but it's not easy. The most useful thing you can do is find someone who understands
what you're going through. And that usually has to be someone outside of the organization, because anyone in the organization is, by the time you're at that level with a psychopath, is paranoid that you are in cahoots with the psychopath and that you're only telling them these things to trap them. That's what happens. When a psychopath's in a group, everyone begins to totally distrust each other. So psychopaths suck trust out of a group like sucking the air out of a room. You know, and there's a quote in the book, a fairly famous psychologist once said, trust is like air. You don't notice it until it's not there. And that's what they do. They suck the trust out of a group. And the result of that is not only do you not trust them, but you don't trust anyone else either. And the result is that talking to someone in the group about your psychopathic boss will probably get you stonewalled responses because they don't know that you aren't part of it, that you aren't some sort of minion of the boss trying to entrap them into admitting things about the boss, gathering information about them. And that is exactly the kind of thing that a psychopath would do. And so it's a reasonable state of belief. So you need to find someone who's outside the organization, whether it's a partner, parent, friend, whatever, someone preferably who's experienced something like this themselves, and who's prepared to listen to your everyday stories about seemingly trivial things and understand that what they're hearing is part of a pattern of behavior. It is enormously reassuring for somebody who is going through this to understand they are not the only person who has ever encountered this. Because what happens is people become gaslit. And I know that's a popular term these days, but it's really, really appropriate with psychopaths. They have you start believing you are the crazy one. And that's what someone in the state you're talking about is believing. They're going to work and they're thinking, maybe I'm just nuts. Maybe I'm imagining all of this. Everybody else seems to get on with them. Maybe I'm the one with a problem, and you need to be able to have someone who's been through it to bounce that off. And in the example scenario I give, the person who survives it all has exactly that, his father, who has been through it all before and has lived this example and knows exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. So I think that whole support network is just so important. And look, for a final thing on this before I change, and I want to talk about your other book, which is just, again, really needed in our society right now. Right. If someone was, say a psychopath was to join an organization, is there... And you know, it's like when you sort of get to know coworkers, you're going for drinks, you're chit-chatting away. And like you say, you might overshare because this person is a master manipulator, right? Yeah. Exactly. So you might just start chatting away, telling them a whole life story. I'm very much like that. You know, I wear my heart on my sleeve. You know, people know me straight away.
No, you just did it.
Yeah, exactly, right? So I'm just like chit-chatting away. And then I realize 3 months down the track, oh God, like if I'd known some warning signs, maybe I'd have been a bit more hesitant. Because what you don't want in an organization is someone to join the business and everyone be really super scared to embrace this person. So is there anything that these little subtleties that people go, oh, I'm going to watch that?
Yeah, there are. So the first thing is, particularly for women who the science on this is really solid, have a more finely attuned sense of empathy, mostly because they have a better ability to receive oxytocin, which is an important part of the circuitry. For women, trust your gut. A lot of women will say, I was, you know, he gave me a funny feeling the first time I saw him. You know, hair stood up, whatever, just I couldn't pin it, just couldn't nail it, but it was just odd. I felt odd. Trust that. It's real. Go with it. If you get that feeling about someone you've just met, then dial down the amount you share with that person a lot. There are more obvious signs if you're, I guess, looking for them. See how they behave in a group. So it's really, really hard, as I said before, to maintain a mask for 10 different people simultaneously. So if you're at a social gathering with them, first of all, they'll avoid the situation where they might have to speak to 10 people simultaneously. But if you do happen to see them doing that, pay attention to timing slips. So one of the big differences between cognitive empathy, which is what psychopaths are very, very good at, which is doing a manual read on your emotional state and then deciding how to react to it, and emotional empathy, which is the automatic system that most humans have, is time. Emotional empathy works in very small parts of microseconds. It is light speed. Cognitive empathy requires observation, thinking, action. It can take 2, 3, 4 seconds, where a person with actual empathy has already reacted instantly. When you see a person in groups trying to maintain their persona for multiple people who might not have anything to do with each other, they will have slips in timing. So you'll see them miss. You'll see them not pick up something that you would pick up instantly. So someone might casually say, as people sometimes do, say something really awful happened to a child of theirs, and everyone around them, all the empaths around them, will react instantaneously in sympathy and so on. And you might notice the psychopath not even notice it. Like, just it just passes them by, and then they see everybody else reacting and think to themselves, oh, okay, I'm supposed to react to that. And then they react. So you'll see timing slips like that. When you see them, don't put them down to distraction or anything like that. This person's flat out trying to stay in sync here, but they're operating with a system that can't react automatically. So if you pay close attention, you'll notice that kind of thing.
Okay, that's really powerful, because, like, I hate the idea of these people going in from one organization to the next, and I just love a system like you just pointed out. There are so a few key things that people could spot it straight away. Because again, I'm in recruitment, and I would hate to think that I am part of this problem, placing these people into organizations and making then the whole culture and the whole workplace toxic. So, you know, is there any questions I can ask as a recruiter, you know, from a HR perspective?
I can say, I mean, a lot of HR people would say they do this anyway, but I would say really do this. Like, really check everything they tell you. Okay. Really check it. if there is something, no matter how small on their resume, if there's a gap in their resume, check it. They hide things. They lie about things. Don't make assumptions that anything in writing is true. They are quite free to lie continuously, because they see zero downside to that. To them, a lie is something you do to get what you want. Whereas to a person with empathy, they worry about the consequences. They worry about, even being dishonest in the first place, all of that sort of thing. And so they're much less likely to do it. Everyone probably, fudges their resume to an extent, but this is different. This is outright lies, where they'll completely make up employers, or they'll just be unexplained gaps. And unless you're really, really carefully scrutinizing, you might miss them. Even things they say in an interview. So they might refer to someone by name or a company by name. Check it. Because the only reason they've given you a name is they believed you needed to hear that name in that interview. It's be absolutely diligent about checking. When you read the stories, and there's lots of case studies in the book of organizations that have employed psychopaths, when you read those stories, the common message that comes through is they didn't thoroughly check the paper. Even high-end professional recruitment companies were not checking gaps in the resume that, if they had checked, probably would have told them, don't employ this person. And what they're facing is an executive who did the interview with the psychopath, who was so charmed that they're prepared to gloss over anything. They think, oh, look, don't come to me with your niggles. This guy is absolutely the best candidate by a country mile. I don't want to hear that he didn't put the right date on something. All of that detail matters.
Okay, that's really solid advice. And one thing that I always do check for, just really naturally, I've been doing this for 10 years, is just those career gaps, those bigger gaps, or even short periods as well. I go, what's going on here? That's interesting.
It's the short ones. So often the gaps that we're missing in some of the Dunlap is one of the case studies I looked through, who who went from company to company to company, going bigger and bigger and bigger, leaving a total trail of destruction. Many tens of thousands of careers completely destroyed by this guy, Chainsaw Al Dunlap. And he, one of the things when they looked back on his career and looked at the resumes he was presenting is that they were really small gaps that he was covering up. You know, like 6 month gaps where he was unemployed, but why was he unemployed? What had happened to the previous employer? And those things were not being checked.
Okay, so that's really, really key for people like myself who own recruitment agencies, that are recruiters, that are HR professionals. Check those gaps, do your due diligence, do reference checks, and be really thorough. Yeah. That's really good. I guess final question.
The other thing, just about reference checks. Yeah. I'm sorry. One of the ones about reference checks is most people really, really want to get rid of a psychopath. Desperately, badly want to get rid of a psychopath. You will get fantastic references. From referees of a psychopath for two reasons. One, they want to get rid of them. Two, they're terrified of them. So they don't want any blowback on them. They just want them out of there. So you will get terrific references about psychopaths.
So if they're too good to be true, that's also a little bit of a red flag as well. Okay. All right. Good to know. My final thought process on it all is that, let's just say there is a business right now that has just got rid of one, and they want to rebuild their culture. They want to build trust in the team again. Any advice for those organizations that really need to like rebuild their culture that's got quite toxic?
First of all, you have to admit that you missed it, like that you completely missed what was going on. You now have systems in place to make sure that you'll pick it up in future. And by the way, there are companies that have developed extraordinarily good systems for doing this. One of the most successful companies in the world is Costco. And Costco has a beautiful system of controlling for psychopaths, which I go to in quite a bit of detail in the book. But in essence, what it devolves to is at any time, any employee of Costco at whatever level can talk to the CEO without repercussions. And when you consider the size of Costco, which is hundreds of thousands of employees worldwide, that's a big ask. But that openness of communication works well to keep psychopaths in check. They thrive in the shadows. They thrive in telling you one thing and you something else. They divide and conquer. They really abhor open communication. And so it's one of the key things. And by the way, coming back to references, just to bore you a little bit more with that one, is if you want to check the references of a psychopath, don't talk to the people they ask you to talk to. Talk to people who worked for them. Find people who worked for them and talk to them. They will give you an honest read.
Again, that's really solid advice. And I absolutely love that case study from Costco, that just anyone can go and see the CEO. That is absolutely fantastic. And I think if any organization is listening to that, I love that policy anyway. I think that CEO should be accessible.
He made a policy of visiting every store once a year. So it's thousands of stores. That's a big ask, right? But he visited every store and he walked around the store so that any employee could encounter him on their walk and just talk to him. And all of the managers, I'm sure Costco employees, psychopaths, but they are controlled psychopaths.
I love that. That's a really good case study. Now, I want to move on to another book that you've written, because I read a lot, and I've been seeing some alarming stats around mental health, burnout, all of these things that are just constantly sort of coming out, suicide rates on the rise. But you've written another book called Brain Reset.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about that book, why you wrote it again? And let's just imagine that someone's, you know, in a toxic workplace right now and may need a little bit of a, you know, some mental health help. So, sort of what can they do to sort of, you know, look after their mental well-being? And why did you write that book as well?
That book didn't come out of, a little out of personal experience, but not mostly. What triggered that in me is understanding what the science was telling us about how chronic stress, and such as the sort, caused by psychopaths, and addiction are related, and they are very much related. and what the biochemistry of that looks like, and more importantly, what you can do about it. Because the psychology profession is frankly not much help. They seem to be almost totally unaware of the more recent work in neuroscience, which helps us really understand how these things work. And I thought this really needed to be brought to the attention, not just so that people understand how these things work, but also understand what they can do about it. So in brief, both chronic stress and addiction elevate a threshold in our brain for dopamine. So just briefly, what is dopamine? Dopamine is the thing that activates us. It makes us move away from danger and towards reward. So interesting experiments done with lab animals, for example, they could have a rat that's absolutely starving to death. They know because they've starved it. Disconnect the dopamine receptors in its brain, place food in front of its mouth, and it will not even be bothered to move the 1 centimeter necessary to grab the food and eat it, even though it's desperately hungry. So dopamine is our motivator. It makes us chase reward and it makes us run from danger. So that, like all self-correcting systems, so we with our sense of smell, for example, we have thresholds. So that if you were to walk into a very smelly room, for example, you would have noticed, this has probably happened many times, you don't smell it after maybe 10 minutes. But if there was a new smell introduced, you'd smell that. So what your brain is doing is setting a threshold, screening out the background noise, and so that you can pay attention to changes, because we operate on the basis of change. So we have a threshold like that for dopamine too. So that if we're in an environment where there is a lot of stress, so say we're in a war zone and there's explosions going off all around us all the time, people in those situations remain very, very calm because of this threshold, because it goes up. They're not triggered, they're not reacting, they're not jumping in relation to explosions unless one is really, really particularly close, and then they are reacting. So that's an important threshold to have, which is that we adjust to the environment. We do the same thing with reward. So if we're in a particularly rewarding environment, there's ice cream all around all the time, we learn to screen it out. It's no longer particularly rewarding. We're not chasing it all the time. We're only interested in the really good stuff. You know, if someone brings out chocolate with the ice cream or something like that. So that's that threshold operating. Now, the downside to that threshold is that it's pushed to the same level by both stress and reward. And that means that if you are in a situation of chronic stress, you have a threshold set as if you are in a situation of chronic reward. Now, chronic reward threshold set, we have a word for it. It's called addiction. So it's the biochemical function that drives addiction, which is that we are chasing enough dopamine to get over the threshold to motivate us to do something. So we keep hitting the dopamine button. We keep following the thing that gave us stimulation in order to get over the threshold. So the result is that if you are in a situation of chronic stress, such as having a boss who's a psychopath or having no money, those are situations of chronic stress, then you are very easily addicted as well, because the same threshold has been set. Just as putting yourself in a situation where you are an addict also creates chronic stress. So it's the same thing. It's in a feedback loop. The problem is that when that level is set that high, it stays that high for about 3 months. So you have to come off dopamine stimulation, either from stress or reward, for about 3 months for it to gradually get back down to base level. While it is high, there's a number of problems that result in the human brain. We develop anxiety, which is in essence an overestimation of reward and stress. So when it's too high, we overestimate potential reward and we overestimate potential danger. The end result is that when we don't have enough dopamine, which is most of the time because the level's too high, we are anxious, meaning we calculate too much risk in the world. So we are afraid of things that normal people are not afraid of. When that anxiety is about other people, we call it paranoia. And if it's allowed to go on for long enough, it becomes psychosis, which is paranoia about the actions and motivations of others. And then that develops into schizophrenia if it goes on long enough. The other thing that happens is that we develop an inability to focus because the body likes to use things for multiple points. And dopamine, besides being our motivator, is also our focus drug. So in order to have sufficient dopamine to focus, it has to reach that threshold level. If we just are doing things that don't do that, so we're in between hits of dopamine, then we are unable to focus. Even though we have enough dopamine normally, because normally our threshold is down here, we would be able to focus. When we are in that state of having these levels too high, we can't focus. And we call a lack of focus ADHD, which is inability to hold a thought in our head for more than a few seconds at a time. That's what dopamine does for us. It enables us to focus. By the way, the current treatment for that, if it can be called that, is to give you a stimulant drug, an amphetamine, which is what Ritalin is, and it will push your dopamine levels up. Now, instantly you can focus because you're up at the right level. Problem is, it just makes the problem worse because that in turn will push that threshold even higher. So I know this is really complicated and difficult without diagrams, but the important takeaway from all of this is it's all related. It all results in anxiety, depression, ADHD, schizophrenia, psychosis, and it can all be cured by simply lowering that threshold. And you might say, well, how do I do that then? And the easy way is do something that produces dopamine, but that doesn't produce the high frequency hits of dopamine that addiction requires. So how do you do that? Well, a nicotine patch is the concept here, which is nicotine produces a hit of dopamine, but it's a bad idea to get your nicotine from cigarettes because the cigarette smoke causes cancer. So what they've sold is nicotine patches where you can get the same hit but without the smoke. We want to do that but without the same hit. We want less of a hit, but we want focus. So the way to do that is do things that require us to focus but which do not hit us continuously with dopamine. So things like if you play a musical instrument, playing an instrument requires an extraordinary amount of focus. There are very, very few people who can just play an instrument and think about something else while they're doing it. It just can't be done. It requires extraordinary focus. Doing anything that requires you to enter what artists and writers call the flow, which is where you are so focused on the task you are doing that time goes by without you even being aware of it. You might do it when you're, say, editing something like this. You might, you're into it, you're doing it, and before you know it, it's 2 hours later. But during that time, when you were that focused, you're producing large amounts of endogenous dopamine. And you were working to provide yourself with a dopamine stimulation that was just under where the threshold required it to be. And because of that, starts to bring the threshold down. So it allows you to do things which are not addictive while you bring the dopamine threshold down. And then after about 3 months, you won't even have to do that, but you'll probably have gotten in the habit of doing it anyway.
It's really interesting when you speak about this because, and I've shared this on the podcast before, I suffered a lot of anxiety for my late 20s. And what you were describing then were those sort of high dopamine hits. But what I was then chasing the next sort of big thing, the next goal, the next this, the next that, the next deal, the next sale. But then when things weren't going the way I wanted them to go, they weren't meeting my expectation, I have a massive crash. And I was just on this roller coaster of just anxiety, low mood, anxiety. Like it was just for about a 3-year period, it got so bad that I was then having panic attacks. But then what was happening is that I was almost anxious about being anxious. And I actually think on reflection, I was addicted to those stress hormones because I was getting those hits as well.
You could describe that as addiction. And in fact, there's a type of addiction which is based on that. Gambling is that. Which is gambling is addiction to the stress of being about to lose a lot of money. And gaming, so computer gaming is that too. So in computer gaming, you're doing a simulated stressful event. You're fighting for your life and then you die. Now, in real life, you only do that once. In gaming, you can do it 50, 60 times an hour.
And it's that continuous hitting of the stress that is addictive. And that's what you're experiencing in real life. And by the way, that bit where you come down again is called disappointment. And depression, another way of saying depression, is just continuous disappointment. So it's really just where what you expected to happen wasn't matched by reality. And the trouble is that the expectation keeps getting higher and higher as that threshold moves up. And so eventually it's impossible for reality to match your expectation.
So true. So true. I guess one other thing I was want to touch upon, because I do worry about this, the younger generation coming up with the screens. You talk about the dopamine hit, then, you know, that constant stimulation on all of the apps and things, the social media, that all of that, what that's doing to young people's brains. Like, I'm so grateful I grew up in a generation where I didn't know what a phone was until I was about 16, right?
And then you probably used it to make telephone calls.
Yeah, correct. Exactly. In text. I had to ask my mum and dad to top up 10p so I could send a text, you know, like, I mean, they were my days. And I look so fondly back on my childhood, but I also think to myself, God, if I'd had an iPhone at that point in my life, I just don't know what I know. My brain would not have been able to cope with that. So,
and not just you. That's the really terrifying part about all of this is we've undertaken since 2011, when the iPad came into circulation, we've undertaken a mass experiment in what happens if we addict everybody, and. When people hear me say that, they think, well, that's a bit extreme. We're not giving them vodka, you know. Well, you might as well be, because these applications are free. They cost billions of dollars to develop, and they're free. Whenever something's free, you're the product. And what they're selling is your attention to the advertiser. Now, there's lots of people making free apps out there. How do they guarantee that theirs is the one of three or four that you put on your phone and that you use all the time? The only way they can guarantee that is to make them addictive. And how do they make them addictive? Because they know all of the science that I just described to you and a lot more. The people who write this code in the industry are called dopamine hackers for a very good reason. They know exactly what they have to do to cause you to get a dopamine spike out of using their app. Now, I'll just give you a couple of examples of the sorts of things they do. So they know that in real life, one of the ways to get a dopamine hit, particularly for females who are sensitive to oxytocin, is do something that your peer group thinks is good and have them tell you they think it's good. So in real life, back in your teenage days, you might have, I don't know, bought a nice jacket or something and they all thought it was terrific. And then you feel really good because they have told you what you've just done is fantastic. And that's how peer groups stay together. The oxytocin glues them together in that way. And that feedback loop produces dopamine hits. So it's addictive. But what the app writers have said is, okay, well, that's mildly addictive. And it makes people behave in a certain way. But how do we make it so that they cannot leave our app? What they found is that you can do a high-speed high-speed simulation of this by simply putting a like button on things. And so you post a photo, 10 million strangers press like. Everyone that says presses like gives you a little surge of oxytocin and therefore a hit of dopamine. So it's a critical mechanism to have a like or the number of views or something like that, because it's part of the addiction mechanism. And then the other part of the addiction mechanism is the bottomless scroll, which they didn't have initially. So most of these apps didn't have this. It only became probably in the last 5 years a big part of most apps. And the interesting thing about the bottomless scroll is it uses a different principle of dopamine stimulation, which is that because they've been observing you and they know what you do and don't like, they'll show you those things in your feed, but they use something called an uncertainty principle of dopamine stimulation. So what the science tells us is that when we know a good outcome is going to happen, we'll get a certain amount of dopamine. When it may or may not happen, we get double the amount. And this is a principle, and gambling relies on, obviously, chance, uncertainty. They've incorporated that into the scroll as well, and they found that they can magnify its potential even more powerfully if it's not predictable, in the sense of not every second thing is something I want to see, but
Maybe it's the second thing this time, then it's the fifth, then it's the tenth, then it's the third, then it's the... So show you a bunch of stuff you don't want to see, and then every now and then show you something you do want to see, but make it unpredictable. And that really ramps up the dopamine, and it's why people can't get off a scroll. All of this thought and design has gone into making something that you can't put down. The result is, just like with gambling or porn or anything else, it raises that that threshold level and makes you prone to anxiety, depression, schizophrenia, et cetera, et cetera. So we are now doing an interesting experiment on our population. Never before in human history have we given every teenager, and by the way, the teenage brain is the most susceptible brain to this, because one of the things that controls this is a chemical called GABA, which is shut down during the period from the start of puberty to early 20s so that that part of the brain can grow. So it's the time when people become addicted to anything. We've known that a long time about alcohol and cigarettes and everything. But with this, what we're going to do, what we've done, is we say, let's take a whole generation of teenage brains, give them 24/7 access to things that are designed to addict them, and then see what happens. And what happens is we are seeing wave after wave of anxiety, depression, and so on just go off the scale with teenagers. We have created a generation of kids with mental health problems. ADHD is out of control. It couldn't possibly be a genetic explanation to have a fivefold increase in the last 10 years. That's insane. It's a direct result of introducing mass addiction.
I'm really conscious of your time, David, but I want to just check you're okay, because I've got perfect, right? Because this is something that actually keeps me awake at night, and I'm not even going to lie about that. I actually think about this a lot. I was sat at the weekend and I was actually reading an article about the suicide rate in young girls has gone up dramatically, and I was reading it and I just feel so emotional about this, because I just go, what is the answer? Because on one hand, I am very pro young girls and young boys and everything getting into technology, and a phone and everything else is going to be part of our new world, right? So I'm like, yes, we do need them to be interacting with this technology. On the other hand, I go, but what is this doing to their young brains? These social media apps, all this technology, all this constant stimulation and dopamine hit. And then I'm sat around in a cafe and all I'm seeing around me is people not talking. They're just on their phones, like a family. I saw the other day in a cafe, a dad, a mum, and two young teenagers all on their phones. I was like, what's the point? Is this the world that we're living in right now? So firstly, there's two parts to this question. Firstly, let's take it from a parent point of view, right? Because I can imagine there's parents listening to this right now, tearing their hair out, knowing all this stuff, wanting to help their kids and going, please get off your phone. But they're just so addicted to it. First and foremost, advice for those parents with young teenagers.
So don't expect them to appreciate you taking away an addictive item from them. They will react the same way a drug addict would react. If they're a boy, they'll react violently. If they're a girl, they'll react manipulatively. But either way, you're going to pay for it. And it's a bridge that most parents don't want to cross. Most parents are working very hard, have very little time with their teenage children as it is, and don't want to spend that time fighting with them. But unfortunately, the answer is you have to. You really have to. You have to imagine that what they're sitting there doing is drinking shots of vodka. Would you stop them doing that? If the answer is yes, then you've got to stop them doing this too. It will be ugly, I guarantee you. But the good thing about this is we are talking about a biomechanical switch that resets after 3 months. And noticeably resets even as early as 2 to 3 weeks. So parents who do this say usually often the time that they'll do it is on the holidays, where they'll say, right, we're on holidays, you don't need the school device, we're leaving it at home, we're going device free. And they'll get shaked down for a week of the holidays where the kids are just absolutely insanely grumpy about everything, irritable about everything, and uncooperative. But then they get bored. And when they get bored, they start to use something that they've never had to use before, which is their imagination. And they start finding things to do. And by the end of a holiday, many parents report that it's like they got their old child back. And then they've got to go back to school and the devices are back and it's starting at zero again. But it gives you an insight into what it can be like. You are not imagining it. It is not
of fiction, these things are as addictive as any addictive substance that they could be consuming, and it has to be treated the same way.
Okay, so you're not going to be popular, but no. You've got to literally just see it as your kid sat there drinking, you know, becoming an addict. It's the same thing, right?
And think about that. Another thing parents often say to me too is, I say, oh, yeah, okay, I agree with all of that, but I do like to let little Johnny, you know, have 2 hours on Saturday afternoons. Is that okay? And my response to that is, well, if you were trying to break little Johnny's alcohol habit, would you let him have a couple of drinks on Saturday afternoon? And the answer is no, absolutely not. Well, it's the same thing. It's the same mechanism. It's the same biochemistry. It's not, so you have to treat it the same.
So in your personal opinion, would you just ban all social media?
Totally ban them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The devices themselves are not evil. And this is the thing you often see people say, oh, screens are evil. It's terrible stuff. Mm-hmm. They can't be using screens. It's not the screen. Most of the stuff on a screen is productive and helpful. But no one's getting addicted to Excel. you know, there's a few apps. There's games, there's porn, there's social media. Take those off. Everything else is perfectly fine.
Okay. All right. That's really good to know. Okay. And then look for those adults then that find themselves in this addictive behavior. And I know actually, yeah. I put my hand up to say at one point, I found myself just automatically picking up my phone, Instagram, LinkedIn, emails, WhatsApp, bang, 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 without even thinking, without being conscious. Now, every single time I pick up my device, I try to every single time go, why am I picking up my phone right now? For what purpose? And I've just been very, very conscious and very intentional when I'm opening up these apps. I'm either going on there to post or do something within it, right?
Yeah.
So, but for those adults listening to this right now, they go, oh, I'm actually feeling like I could be a bit addicted to this, to these apps. Any advice for how they can reset their brains?
Find something else to do that requires you to focus. You know, what the advice I gave people in the sugar book that I wrote was find something else that you find just as pleasurable as having whatever that sugary snack is and do that. Schedule that in. You know, if you know that you always like to sit down in front of the television with a couple of mint slices, then find something to substitute into that habit that isn't full of sugar. And people report that works brilliant. So the same thing goes here, which is if you know, okay, every night I like to sit down and have a good old browse through Instagram at 8 o'clock every night and spend an hour or two doing that. Okay, find something else to do. You're doing it because you want dopamine stimulation. You're doing it because your brain says we need dopamine stimulation and knows it can get it from that. So get dopamine stimulation from something else. If you play a musical instrument, do that. If you build model airplanes, do that. If you play a sport, do that. The important thing is do something that requires you to focus.
Okay, really good advice. David, honestly, I think we could go for another hour and, you know, you've also written another book that I'm passionate about, which is nutrition, sugar, everything. Yeah. So I absolutely love your work and I'm really, really pleased that you've come on the podcast because I just know so many people are going to have got so much from today's episode. I feel like we've touched on so much, but where can I send people to find out more about yourself and your work and grab a copy of your books?
You can get the books anywhere. Amazon's probably the cheapest. They're not paying me to say that. That's just my experience.
Yeah.
Just if you go to davidgillespie.org, just all one word, davidgillespie.org, I post articles about, so I don't just write the books. In between the books, if I see something in the news, I write something about it and relate it to this science. So if you want to follow along there, you can do that. Or I'm also on Facebook. You can do that too. By the way, Facebook's less and less addictive these days because it's all 99% ads. So you're probably at less risk of it just going there.
100%. But look, keep doing what you're doing because by writing books like Toxic at Work, you're making people feel like they're not going mad and they're not on their own. And there are, you know, this happens to other people, not just them. So thank you.
You're not even not on your own. It's everybody. Almost every single person
has this experience. So you just have to be mindful of the fact that if you talk to someone in your own workplace, they could be working for the psychopath.
And on that note, David, thank you so much for coming on today, and I look forward to following your work.
Ah, thanks, Georgie.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you've got this far, that honestly means the world to me and lets me know that you've got a lot of value from today's episode. So if I could just ask you to do one thing, pull out your phone and please leave a quick review. It honestly would mean the world to me. It will help this podcast grow and get our message out there to more people. So if you could do that for me, that would be amazing. And please reach out and just let me know what you want to hear more about, what you're interested in. It will just also help me make sure that I'm continuing to speak to topics that are relevant and also find guests that are real true experts in what you want to know more about. So have an amazing day. Thank you so much for doing that, and I can't wait to share the next episode with you. Thank you.